And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings to you some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. Today is no exception. My guest, Matt Frad, he is a speaker, a podcaster, and he's an author of a very significant book. In fact, I read it this week with great interest, and I thought this is a book that everyone needs to read. It's called The Porn Myth, and exposes the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. I've often said that pornography is an enslaving addiction. It's a violation of marriage vows, and it's a precursor to increasingly dangerous and degrading sexual practices. And all of that is borne out in this book. Again, the title, The Porn Myth, Exposing the Reality Behind the Fantasy of Pornography. Matt has a lot of interesting things to say. We'll talk about this and a whole lot more on today's edition of Hank Unplugged. Matt, it is great to have you with me.
G'day, Hank. It's lovely to be on the podcast. You know, the first time I heard of you, because being a Catholic, I wasn't in your orbit for a while. The first time I heard of you was that radio debate you did between James White and Jimmy Akin.
Oh, wow.
I used to work for Catholic Answers as an apologist, and so that's when I first came across you. So it's an honor to hear from you and an honor to be invited to be on the podcast.
Well, I was just on Catholic Answers maybe a month or so ago, and
cool.
We're talking about my conversion to Orthodoxy.
Well, I'm an Eastern Catholic, so I go to a Byzantine Catholic church, and so the liturgy is almost identical. You pray for the Patriarch, we pray for Francis.
Yeah, well, you're not far from the truth, Matt. You're getting there.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. One step at a time.
One step at a time. I loved your book. I mean, I've been talking about this for years, but there was so much in the book that I simply did not understand. And I'm sure if I didn't understand some of the things in the book, a lot of other people are in the same boat.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you liked it. It took about 4 years to write, research, and edit. And it's a non-religious response to pro-porn arguments, as you know. So anyone could hand this to a friend who isn't necessarily religious. And I just tried to lay out the arguments as best I could with a lot of the scientific findings that have been coming out of academia for the last 40 or so years.
And you sort of wrote the book in a question-answer format. So there are a lot of myths that are addressed in the book.
Yeah, so there's about 30 to 40 myths that I tried to rack my brain to come up with. What is it that people say when they try to justify a porn use? You know, they might say something like, well, it's liberating for women, or it's, you know, it's not addictive anyway. It's just a bit of fun, and as long as you don't go overboard, or it doesn't really impact the brain. Maybe anime porn, cartoon porn might be okay, those sorts of things. Maybe masturbation's okay, and then I just, yeah, sort of like in Thomas Aquinas fashion, tried to present the arguments for that position and then showed why they don't work. And that if anyone is pro-science and pro-love, that's a good reason to be anti-porn. So I'm not first inviting people to embrace the truths of the Christian faith before they reject porn. I'm saying you've got good reason to want to reject it now.
You're also co-creator of Victory, which is an app that provides a strategic battle plan for winning the struggle against pornography. You're into this subject, and I think for good reason. I've often said that if you think about pornography, you think about this not as a sort of a niche issue. This is a macro issue. If you think of all of the strategic issues of life, marriage is at the apex, and this is something that devolves the marriage bound.
Right. I thought about this the other day. You know, Marvel doesn't have a great time coming up with villains, and so I have an idea for Marvel. They construct a character who seeks to destroy civilization by destroying the fundamental building blocks of that civilization by perverting the act proper to, you know, the marriage bed. Because once sex goes, so does marriage. And once marriage goes, so does the family. And once family goes, so goes civilization. And so if it seems that Christians are spending a lot of time talking about sex, it's for good reason. Because if sex isn't sacred, what action is, you know? Once that gets perverted, so does the culture. Have a look around us. I just saw this tweet today of some mother, you know, celebrating the fact that her second grader in a public school was educating us all on the, LGBTQ stuff. And I just thought, this is insanity. And it all, yeah, we pervert sex. That's how it all that's how it all unfolds, I think.
You know, just about the time that people are talking about pornography as being something that is settling, that is maybe even helpful to society, you come along and you say, absolutely not. This is one of the most perverse practices imaginable. So society, by and large, seems to be ratifying pornography. You're saying exactly the opposite.
Right. And what's actually been quite exciting and something that gives me optimism is that there are a lot of people in the culture now who are speaking out against pornography, right? Like Pamela Anderson, James Hetfield, the lead singer of Metallica, just narrated an anti-porn documentary. Comedian Chris Rock spoke openly about how porn just led to his divorce. We can actually go on and on. It's kind of exciting that, you know, there's these big secular groups online. My friend Alexander Rhodes runs the website nofap.com. There are over 200,000 people within that forum on Reddit, most of whom aren't religious, but they would just like to have a more interesting life, please. They would like to have sexual function back, which pornography has taken away. And so I'm, you know, speaking at conferences alongside Mormons, Marxist, atheist, feminist professors, all sorts of people who we might disagree about many things, but the one thing we all agree on is that the world would be better without sexual exploitation. So it's kind of exciting to see.
I like what you've written in saying that the real problem with pornography isn't that it shows too much, but it shows too little of the human person. Expand on that.
Right. So the problem with porn isn't nudity. The human body is what is the human body? It expresses the mystery of the human person. It's not an animate provider of pleasure like a steak or a keg of beer, right? It's, you know, we don't inhabit our bodies, we are our bodies. And so to exploit the body is to exploit the person. If the body were worthless, you couldn't degrade it. You know, when you say you degraded her or him, that presupposes that she or he had some grade to begin with. And so it's precisely because the body is good that porn is wicked, right? The same thing with sex. Like, sex is good. If it wasn't, you couldn't make it ugly. You can't make mud ugly. And sexual desire is good. Well, whose idea was it anyway, right? I mean, God, in the first commandment to humanity, Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, he says, be fruitful and multiply. And I don't think he meant grow grapefruits and invent calculators. He meant have sex and fill the world. So it's precisely because sex is so powerful and beautiful and good that sexual desire is too, that nudity is. I mean, this is why I love taking my children to museums. I want them to see beautiful naked art that expresses the mystery of the person. But porn doesn't do that, you see. For all of its exposure, porn always ends up suppressing and obfuscating the mystery, the personhood of the performer. You know, I don't care about her thoughts or her dreams or her past or what happened to her when she was young, or all of that would get in the way of what I'm attempting to do here. In a sense, and this might sound a little hyperbolic, but I think there's a point here. In a sense, porn does what death does. It separates with knife-like precision the mind, the person, the soul, however you want to put it, and the body. You think of a Playboy centerfold or something like that. You know, she doesn't have to be alive. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care about her. And it seems to me if there was ever a behavior in which you were to engage in where the personhood of the other should be recognized and affirmed, it ought to be the marital embrace. And that's precisely what isn't affirmed in pornography. And that's why it's so, you know, it's so ghastly. But I mean, all of that said, I don't want people listening thinking that I'm coming down hard on them, because pornography feels great. It's very pleasurable. It makes me feel powerful, masculine, strong, in control. And of course, many young women struggle with pornography, and they might say something like, well, it makes me feel desired. It makes me feel pleasurable. Sometimes we can only begin to overcome something when we admit we like doing it. I remember hearing of an alcoholic who said he was only able to begin to break free of alcoholism when he admitted that he loved getting drunk, but that it was killing him, and so he had to make a choice. So I think we have to be honest about the worm on the end of the hook, as it were, the thing we go after, the thing we get from it, but then very soberly admit
that we don't want to be these sorts of people. Like, I don't want to be the kind of husband who has to creep away from my wife late at night to have an intimate encounter with my iPhone. I don't want to have to diligently delete my history file so my kids don't find out dad's a porn addict. That isn't the sort of person I want to be. I don't want to be remembered as the guy, you know, who consumed this much porn every day. Even if the church had nothing to say on the matter and, you know, the scriptures had nothing to say on the matter, it's just not who I want to be. I want my life to be good and true and beautiful, and I want my sex life to be good and true and beautiful. And it seems to me, and all the research seems to be backing this up, that if you want to be sexually dissatisfied, then pornography is the way to go. That's what leads to sexual ugliness and falseness. And, well, there you go. I'm ranting now. But
no, you're not. I mean, I love what you're talking about. And I was thinking as you were talking, Matt, that my good friend Joe Dallas, he lived the gay lifestyle for many, many years. And I don't know of anybody on the planet today that knows more about that subject and delivers it in a more compassionate, compelling way than Joe Dallas. And I was thinking about some similarities with you in that you're not talking about something that you don't know anything about. You've experienced this from an early age. You know precisely how it enslaves, and therefore there's a passion that comes out in your speaking and your writing. It's not like you're ranting or rambling. I mean, you are passionate and for good reason.
Well, thank you. I hope it's a coherent rant, if nothing else. That's right. I mean, I like almost every male on the planet, you know, has seen pornography. And when I was 12 and 13, my best friend's mum, he was a single child and she wasn't married, she would buy us porn. She'd drive us down to the movie store. She'd buy us VHS tapes and even buy us hard liquor. And so at the age of 12, here we are drinking vodka, pretending to like it, watching porn. That was me at 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. My parents had no idea about it. This was before the time of the internet. So that was just the world I was immersed in. I never felt comfortable with it. I liked doing it, but I always felt sort of like that this wasn't particularly masculine behavior. It wasn't until I was 17 years old and encountered the person of Jesus Christ that I decided I didn't want to live like this and that I shouldn't be living like this, and thus began the long road to recovery. And of course, recovery isn't something that happens in an instant. It's not something that happens to you. And I think too often we treat recovery like that. Well, when will I be free? But of course, as Christians, our goal is heaven, and sexual purity is part of the fuel, right, that's going to help us get there, if you want to put it that way. But it's better, I think, to think of recovery as a daily choice that I make by my actions.
And I think that when you think about the Christian life, it's not just heaven at the end of the rainbow. It's Christ came to give us life that is life to the full in the present. And if you're engaging in these behaviors, there's something that happens to your soul. There's something that is so dissatisfying and debilitating in the present that you can't experience life that's life to the full.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this topic. Like, I feel like one of the things that prevents the seed of the gospel to penetrate the hearts of men and women, part of that is that they are up to their eyeballs in degrading pornography. I mean, how long can one keep within one's mind the human person is a good towards which the only proper and adequate attitude is love, and at the same time subject myself to, you know, body-punishing, women-hating porn? I mean, I'm not going to be detailed here, but if people are listening and they haven't seen pornography since, you know, the 80s, it's something very different. You know, like today, most porn sites have rape categories and shame categories, and this is the first thing children are exposed to, not the whole Playboy centerfold thing that we might remember from our youth. And so, yeah, it's one of those obstacles, I think, to the reception of the gospel. And that's why I'm passionate about it.
And it really rewires the brain as well. I mean, I thought that was one of the great insights in the book. I mean, it's not new, but you have certainly hammered home the point that there's neuroplasticity in the brain and that pornography actually ends up, in a very technical sense, rewiring our anatomy in that capacity.
Right. And this isn't scare tactics. This isn't hyperbole. This is what the data is showing. So as I sit here, I believe there are 39 peer-reviewed neuroscience-based studies on porn users. and every one of them supports the addiction model. Now, I know people, especially in the Christian community, might feel a little uncomfortable with that term addiction because they might think it's a word that people use to escape culpability or that it's overused. And I agree with that, but just because something can be abused doesn't mean it can't be used appropriately. But what we are seeing is all sorts of things, like there was a study that came out in 2014 from the Max Planck Institute in Germany. It's like the Harvard of Germany. And they discovered that to the degree in which one was looking at pornography, there were smaller parts of his brain. Your brain becomes desensitized, so you feel you have to continually watch more deviant forms of pornography to feel normal. This leads to all sorts of things like anxiety and erectile dysfunction and premature ejaculation and all of this. I mean, if you've been wondering why you've been seeing more commercials for Viagra lately, there might be a good reason for that. And again, this isn't a scare tactic come up with by some Christian group. These are people like Dr. Abraham Morgenthaler, who's the clinical urologist at Harvard Medical School, or Dr. Norman Doidge, who wrote the book The Brain That Changes Itself. You know, these aren't Christian people, but they're saying without a doubt we're seeing a huge spike in erectile dysfunction in young men because their brains have become accustomed to pixels on a screen that they don't know how to interact with a real-life person. And so you might get married one day only to discover that it's not working because you've burnt your brain out on this stuff. So that's real. That's scary, and it should be scary, and it's bloody well true. There's my friend Gary Wilson. He's an atheist. He runs the website yourbrainonporn.com. It's a great website in which it compiles all the data coming out of academia that you can go read for yourself. Again, not science fiction, science. And for this reason, more people are turning against porn. It's sort of like the tobacco apologists back in the 90s who tried to tell us that there was no connection between smoking and cancer. You say that today, and any teenager is going to laugh at you or think you're joking. Something similar is happening. You know, I think the culture is beginning to turn against porn because when everybody is either themselves addicted to porn, struggling with porn to some capacity and sees their negative effects, or loves somebody who does, it becomes more and more difficult to believe the worn-out mantra from the porn industry that this is just, you know, fine behavior for well-rounded adults and don't get carried away and so forth. It's just a joke.
Did you grow up in the Aussie culture?
Yeah. Yep.
What's that like? I mean, if you compare it to America, I mean, you compare Europe to America. Oftentimes, people will tell you Europe is far down the track from where we are. Is that true of the Australian culture?
I suppose it depends on what you mean. I mean, if you're talking about sort of socialism or sort of liberal culture, or I'm not sure what you might mean. I think that the internet leveled the playing field somewhat. So perhaps prior to the internet, there was more true Australian culture. Since the internet came in, it kind of feels like we're all becoming a sort of monolithic blob. I don't even know if it's a culture anymore. Just if culture means life shared in common, I'm not sure we have that. Getting drunk on New Year's Eve and having a hangover the next day isn't much of a culture, but I'm being pessimistic. I'm sorry. It's similar. It's similar, especially in regard to pornography. I mean, Australians, I'm sure, no doubt consume pornography at the same rate per capita as Americans do.
What is the sense of having a relationship with God in any sense, like in Australia as opposed to here? Same thing? Pretty similar?
Yeah. Yeah, it's much more secular, I think you'd say, than America. Like, I believe there are still Walmarts that you could walk into that would sell Christian t-shirts. That's absolutely not a thing in Australia. So certainly we'd be more secular in that sense. But there are pockets of tremendous hope in Australia. So, I mean, I think the evangelical church is growing. There's a lot of signs of hope in the Catholic and Orthodox churches. You know, as society becomes increasingly anti-Christian, in my estimation, it seems like we're either going to have to regain what we have and stop allowing the culture to chip away at it and make compromises with it, or just sort of become consumed by it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're living in a time in which the culture is conforming Christians to their presuppositions as opposed to Christians being salt and light. I've often said that the problem is not the culture. Pagans are going to do what pagans do. That's their job description. What else would they do? The problem is that Christians aren't being salt and light, that they're not leavening the culture. So I think it's It's cool to hear what you said about Australia. That's exactly what I presumed in talking to friends of mine that are Australian. It's a more secular culture, but there are signs that the secular culture can't carry the day, and now Christians are starting to have an impact there that's quite significant.
Right. I really feel like Christians need to return to natural law if they want to put forth a coherent position, because secularism isn't coherent. I mean, even if you consider abortion, it's ridiculous. I mean, is it wrong for big, strong people to kill little, weak, innocent people or not? And if it's not, what does wrong mean? And if it is, how can you keep justifying it? You know, and I think it's sad for me when I see Christians usually in Protestant denominations who seem to be caving on issues that are foundational. But of course, because they've got, and I'd love your take on this, maybe we disagree strongly here, I'm not sure, but because they rely on sola scriptura, they say, well, it doesn't say anything about, you know, masturbation in scripture, or it doesn't say anything about homosexual acts, or it does, but we can explain them away, and, you know, without basing our understanding of scripture in natural law.
Yeah, and also having some historical context within which to think. I mean, people, when they Right. think about Christian history, they think maybe back 40 or 50 years, maybe they think back to the Reformation, but they really don't know what the early Christian church believed in all these matters. So I think being not only biblical, but historically
literate. Right, like if the church fathers, let's say, were unanimous on a particular moral position, and now we've all abandoned it, that should cause us pause, to say the least.
Yeah, and particularly in the fact that most people don't know what the church fathers said, if they know what the church fathers were. So, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the big problems is that people, it's not only sola scriptura, it's solo scriptura. You know, maybe a play on words, but it's me and my Bible. It's not exactly what the definition is denotatively, but I think about people, me and my Bible, and
Cut off from a tradition.
Cut off from a tradition, absolutely. And as a result of that, we have all kinds of problems. So people look at Roman Catholics as though Catholics have a crass system of works righteousness, or Orthodox as being a religion to be cursed because, again, a crass system of works righteousness, where in reality, neither Orthodoxy nor Catholicism is a crass system of righteousness, nor do Catholics and Orthodox people put one up against the other, as though.
Right, and sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree with that, and I feel like I'm a big fan of the Benedict option when it's understood the way it was intended to be understood, not when it's misrepresented. And so, I'm a big fan of ecumenism, and rather than sort of criticizing my Christian brothers and sisters who might be separated from the Catholic Church, I'm more interested in inviting them to embrace things like natural law, not telling them to become Catholic yet, although, of course, as a Catholic, I would want that. But just, you know, we need to be banding together here against an insane culture. It's like we're in an insane asylum, and those in charge have gone insane, and there are a few people who are hanging on to sanity. That might sound a little self-congratulatory, but I don't really care. I think it's true. And it's like we kind of got to bind together here, as Peter Kraft put it, when a maniac is at the door, feuding brothers reconcile. I like that.
No, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, you think about Benjamin Franklin saying that if we don't hang together, we're all going to hang separately. And so I think the fusion that needs to take place in the Christian church is oftentimes outside the purview of most Christians. It has to happen. I'm not saying that we have to get rid of all of our distinctives, but we have to recognize that we have a oneness within the context of the essentials of the historic Christian faith. That's why the mantra of our ministry is in essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, and all things charity.
Augustine. Absolutely. And this is why I can have more in common with an evangelical Protestant than some liberal Catholic, because he's more faithful to Catholicism than the Catholic is.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some respects, yeah. Anyway, we've gone far afield, haven't we?
No, well, let's get back to pornography. Interesting conversation. Pornography oftentimes is not understood from a denotative perspective, but when you understand it from a denotative perspective, when you understand the etymology of the word, things begin to change in your mind very quickly.
Right. Yeah, etymology can be helpful sometimes. Pornography comes from two Greek words, porne, graphpane, which means loosely the writing or perhaps drawing of the prostitutes. That graphpane, so we get the word graffiti and calligraphy, those sorts of things. So that's what it means. Now, what would be a decent definition of it? This is a shorthand one, which may not be perfect, but I think is not bad. You might say pornography is material which depicts erotic behavior, which is in either intended to sexually arouse or by and large has that effect, you know. And so if that's a good enough working definition, then you can say things like, is 50 Shades of Stupid, you know, material which depicts erotic behavior, however poorly written, intended to sexually arouse? And I think the obvious answer is yes. But there might be some instances where we're not sure. I'm not pretending it's always black and white, but... You know, I think most of the cases we do know when it is pornography, and that's my basic definition. What do you think?
Well, you've also pointed out that it entered the English language in the mid-19th century.
Right.
And that the meaning has to do with prostitution.
Right. So pornography is meant to serve an erotic function like a prostitute is. So, and here's a good way to put it, right? Like, if you went to a porn producer, porn director after a screening of their latest flick, say, I'm not sure if they have them, and you were to say, hey, great film, really lovely, love the dialogue, very good, you know, and he'd look at you like, uh-huh, and you kept going on about, you know, how lovely the music was, the music score, and at some point he might look at you quizzically and say, good, did it get you off? And if you looked at him and said, goodness, no, are you serious? I'm sorry, what are you talking about? The porn director would think you were making fun of him because his clear goal was to produce something that served an erotic function like that of a prostitute. You know, similarly, if you went to Michelangelo or someone else painting nudes and said, wow, that's really getting me turned on here, he might question your psychological health or worry that his... paintings had that effect. So I think the goal is to get the intention of the artist and the intention of the viewer in sync with the dignity of the human person. Because at the end of the day, porn isn't created for the sake of beauty, and art isn't created for the sake of masturbation. I think we could probably boil it down that way.
A lot of people listening in might be thinking, you know what, Matt is all too graphic with his language. We got to make sure kids are not in the room hearing what he has to say. But I think you'd say, I'm asking the question, probably exactly the opposite. I mean, kids are exposed to this at a very, very early age, and therefore we better wake up and smell the coffee.
Right. So I think I'd say yes and no. I mean, I think parents are clearly the primary educators of their children, and it ought to be them, not some random Australian explaining these things to them. So I'm very sympathetic to that. The last thing we want to do is scandalize our children. We know what Christ said about those who would scandalize these little ones. That said, I am of the opinion that we ought to begin talking to our children about the age of six about what pornography is. And that's because at the age of six, they're either given a tablet or they use it at a friend's house or they use it at school. And so they're very likely to come across something pornographic. And we don't need to scandalize them. We can just say something like this. You know, if somebody shows you or if you ever see pictures or videos of people who are showing parts of their body that their bathing suit should cover, you should always tell mommy and daddy, and we'd be very proud of you for doing that. You might think you'd be in trouble, but you wouldn't be. We'd actually be very proud of you. And you might say, well, that's what pornography is. And use that word, too. So, you know, I've been in stores and my son has pointed at, you know, Sports Illustrated or something and said, Dad, is that pornography? I went, yeah, pretty much. And one of the corporal works of mercy is to clothe the naked. So why don't we turn these around here for the poor people and for this woman's dignity, you know? But I don't think that conversation should come out of the blue. It should be built upon an ongoing conversation that we have with our children about the goodness of their bodies and why they ought to treat them with reverence and look upon other people with reverence, you know? And that's why I'd say I'd recommend, you know, having a beautiful painting of the breastfeeding Madonna in one's house or something like that to, you know, to show the beauty of breasts and what they're for and, you know, the even naked art, you know, Michelangelo's David or something. There's a way in which the human body can be depicted that does justice to the person.
The internet. I mean, you think about the numbers of people that are becoming addicted to pornography and earlier on. The statistics that I read in your book are simply mind-blowing. 63% of men, 21% of women. We did an article, by the way, in the Christian Research Journal about the increasing addiction to pornography of women.
Right, yeah, and so that's. I'm glad you brought that up. Unfortunately, for the longest time, I think many of us have been saying things like porn is a guy's issue, girls are more into romance novels, and I do think that there's some truth to that. I don't know how many men went out and bought 50 Shades of Grey. But that said, I'm finding that comment increasingly alienating to those that I speak to. If I got up in front of a high school crowd and said men are more visual than women, I think it just wouldn't resonate with a lot of women. And I think many women look at pornography, and young girls do too, and in a way that wasn't the case back in the 80s and 90s. And part of that is because they were exposed to porn when they were like seven. And they should have found it interesting. That's the thing. If your kid's normal, he or she should find sex interesting. And if he sees pornography, he'll find within himself a cauldron of emotions, like arousal, maybe disgust, maybe, you know, pleasure or curiosity. That's all normal. And if we haven't educated our children about what porn is, what to do when they see it, or we haven't locked down our devices with things like Covenant Eyes, which is the best accountability and filter on the web, then they're going to see it. And they might not bring it up to us, but they might go back to it from time to time. And it'll become like a pacifier that they turn to when they feel emotionally turbulent, to try and settle themselves in the way perhaps you and I did when we were teens. We'd call up a friend on the house phone, and if we couldn't get through to them, we called another friend. If we couldn't get through to them, we'd call another friend. What we were doing is trying to sort of settle or regulate our emotional affect. And we wouldn't have used that language, of course. But today, we can train ourselves from a young age to pacify, to settle our emotional turbulence with a screen and with pornography, and that can be a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, that's another issue that you've touched on in your book, in fact, underscored pretty significantly, and that is that porn is oftentimes viewed as an aid to enhance intimacy. And I remember a quote from your book where you quote Dear Abby saying that couples can watch porn to spice up their sex lives as long as both individuals are comfortable with it. And that's part of what you were touching on earlier when we were discussing the fact that the culture itself is giving a sense of legitimacy to not only pornography, but the porn industry in general.
Yeah, and we're seeing this more and more, even on Netflix. I mean, I try not to make a habit of watching the latest Netflix series shows, because there's a lot of pornographic content in there that just wouldn't have been there 20 years ago because it's becoming so normalized. But yeah, the idea that porn can spice up your sex life, well, it'll make it more pleasurable, perhaps, but there's a difference between pleasure and intimacy. If you went out and had sex with a prostitute, that would probably be very exciting and pleasurable. But it wouldn't be intimacy. I mean, there's clearly a difference here. I've heard intimacy is explained as into me see. And the idea at that most intimate moment, I should turn my eyes away from my beloved onto a screen to watch, for the most part, I think it's fair to say, emotionally troubled women pretend to enjoy sex or be abused. And to pretend to enjoy it is the not at all what intimacy is. So things can be pleasurable but deadly. If I jumped off a building, it might feel pretty bloody fun until I hit the ground, you know.
What about the addictive nature of pornography? I want you to give people a little insight on dopamine.
So dopamine is a neurotransmitter that plays a key role in the pleasure reward centers of our brain. It incentivizes us to perform actions that are conducive to our survival and that of our genes. So on a hot day, you walk inside and maybe there's a cold glass of beer or Coca-Cola. That give it to me now feeling is dopamine. Without dopamine, we wouldn't be as incentivized to eat or have sex or win a game. Sex might be as exciting as eating celery or something. It just, the species might end up dying. So that's good. Dopamine's good. But what we've discovered is when you look at pornography compulsively, a downgrading occurs. Dopamine actually begins to shrink. And then the reward center in the middle of your brain is in a state of dopamine craving, you see. It's like we've reset the pleasure thermostat in our brain and need more of that drug, whatever the drug is, and harder forms of it. And in the case of pornography, that would be more deviant forms of it in order to feel normal, aroused. And this is why people always escalate in one of two ways. They watch a lot more of porn than they used to, or they begin watching, as I said, more deviant forms of it. And why? Well, to boost the dopamine up enough so that I can feel pleasure again, because the old stuff isn't doing it anymore. So you can use the word addiction in a psychological sense, and of course there's an in-house debate among psychologists and psychiatrists as to what that means, whether it's appropriate to use it and that sort of thing. Perhaps you could use it in a theological sense. You know, you might say addiction is what happens when you bring your hunger for the infinite to a finite, mutable thing. But I'm using it in the sort of neurological sense, and that is to say, so if somebody says, well, porn can't be addictive because it's not a drug, that's hopelessly out of touch with what we know through modern neuroscience, right? Because in the, say, the DSM-5 put out by the American Psychiatric Association, they have pathological gambling as a natural addiction. I think most people would agree that that's addictive. However, nothing's ingested, nothing's injected. Well, same thing can be true with pornography. It's not about a chemical you put into your body. Natural substances such as pornography and sex and gambling can be just as addictive as external substances can. And again, that's not an excuse to hide behind the term addiction and not seek help. That doesn't mean you're not culpable for getting yourself into this addiction in the first place. But it does mean that we should have sympathy and empathy and compassion on those who are in an addictive state and seek to get them help. And saying pray harder isn't really that helpful. It would be like saying to somebody who was exhibiting signs of clinical depression, well, look, Philippians chapter 4, verses 4 through 8, don't you know? It says, Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. So therefore, rejoicing is a choice and you've just got to choose it and pray more. I think most people would say, well, that's kind of irresponsible. Yeah, you ought to pray, and God wants healing for you, but that doesn't mean there aren't natural things that can help bring that about. It's like if you were hungry, you wouldn't pray to be filled if eating was an option. And so I think in addition to telling people to pray, we ought to point them to good therapists and 12-step groups and accountability partners and all sorts of practical things that without which they might not find long-lasting healing.
You know, what's interesting about that is in some fields, you can't do that. So you find behaviors that are addictive, behaviors that are detrimental to people. Right now in California, for example, there's a bill, AB 2943, and it does not allow you, if someone comes in with a sexual dysfunction, to go against the cultural narrative. And in some ways, I think we'll probably end up in the same place with respect to pornography, unless people like you get this message out through people like me and many others. I mean, this is a very significant issue we can't be silent about, and the ramifications need to be communicated. Not only the ramifications that you talked about, but you've also written in your book about erectile dysfunction. So you think about your statistic, 1992, only 5% of males age 18 to 59 had ED. In 2012, a Swiss study, 30% age 18 to 24 had ED. That is a mind blower to me, quite frankly.
Yeah, and that's why I think we should stoop to conquer. That's why, I like to call it, and I've heard this from Dr. Gail Dines, the Gulliver strategy. You know, how do you tie down the beast? Well, you bit by bit. And I think different things are going to be incentivizing to different people. So just to use an analogy again with smoking, you know, I mean, you would think that putting a large sign on packets of cigarettes that said, this will give you cancer. And in my country, they actually show you, you know, what a cancerous lung looks like or something. It's not enough. We keep buying and we keep smoking and we don't care. And so someone might say, well, okay, well, it'll hurt your children, secondhand smoking. Nah, don't really care. Well, I remember my mum put a sticker on my dad's workbox that said, kiss a non-smoker, enjoy the difference. All right. that might not be the most noble reason to quit smoking, but it's a reason. Let's begin wherever we can begin, right? And I think something similar with pornography. Like, I might go into an old boys' school and talk about the morality of pornography, they might not be interested. But if I tell them that their penises might not work, suddenly there's awkward silence and they'd like some more information. It doesn't mean we should stop there. I think pornography is intrinsically evil, right? So even if it wasn't addictive, even if it didn't cause erectile dysfunction, even if it didn't cause marital breakdown, I think it's wrong in and of itself because of what it is, because you shouldn't treat people merely as means to an end, especially not a selfish end. And so, but yes, I think stooping to conquer is a good idea. And so beginning with the science, you know, you don't, this doesn't need to be a moral issue right away. I've had friends of mine who are atheists who say they quit porn because just for that reason, they couldn't have sex with their girlfriend. But then all of a sudden, they began to realize, wow, I'm beginning to feel all sorts of emotions that I haven't allowed myself to feel because I kept turning to porn. Or, wow, maybe we shouldn't be treating people like consumable goods. And all of a sudden, they bit by bit began to wake up to the immorality of it. So that's, again, what the book's about. I'm okay stooping to conquer.
What about the myth, Matt, that porn empowers women? That's a fairly pervasive myth, I would say.
Yeah, this is a myth that it's nice to believe, because if I'm the sort of person who likes to stimulate myself to pictures of people being abused on a screen for payment, it's very helpful if I can also tell myself that not only am I a gentleman, but that I'm contributing to the flourishing of women all around the world or something. But that's just absolute nonsense. There's nothing liberating about choosing to be a sex object. I would put it this way. Being cool about being degraded doesn't make being degraded any more cool. And so someone can tell you that they find this liberating, but what else would they say? This is their means of income at the moment. But speak to that woman 5 years after she's got out of the industry, and I promise you it's a different story. So I have a podcast called Love People Use Things, and just the other week I interviewed a porn star for an hour about what it was like and why she ended up getting out. And she agreed with me, because I've worked alongside of several people who've been in the porn industry. She's like, I can't tell you one woman who didn't suffer some serious form of neglect or abuse as a child. That's just the boring narrative that they'll all tell you. This idea that you have a healthy life and that you end up getting into it, I think it's just a fiction that we have to tell ourselves. And, you know, I'm a fan of some of the things Friedrich Nietzsche said. He had this notion of resentiment. And the idea with that, he says, is when you feel yourself impotent to attain a particular good, you demonize the good. You turn the virtue into a vice and the vice into a virtue. So if I cannot control myself, well, I have two options. I either say I'm weak, or I look to people like Matt Fratt and say, you're a frigid, uptight, anti-sex prude. And it's a lot easier to do that because I don't have to change. I have to demonize chastity, right? Demonize people who are opposed to pornography. And that's, I think, what we're seeing when you hear people say porn's liberating to women. I mean, what woman are you talking about? The one in the industry? The wives, ask them if they feel empowered by their husband's porn use. Your daughters, do they feel empowered at having to live up now to these apparent standards that they feel they have to live up to? Which woman in particular do you feel is being empowered by this? I think it's just nonsense.
So this is a pervasive myth, because if you have Dear Abby saying that pornography can actually be okay, it can actually help you with sexual intimacy, she's tacitly endorsing something that is demeaning to women in general.
Right. Demeaning to women, demeaning to men. Because I think at the heart of every man is the desire to be a protector, and porn turns him into a predator. Maybe we could say at the bottom of the desire every woman is a desire to be treasured, but porn turns her into a target. And so neither of us get what we want. It promises us, like most sin does, something good, you know. You think, well, I'll go to porn and I'll be excited, but we become bored. Or you go in order to become free to do whatever you want and you become enslaved. Or you go for, for adult entertainment, you become increasingly juvenile. I think ask anybody who's been struggling with this for any length of time, you know, have you ever met an addict who you found interesting? I mean, any interesting person you've ever met, someone you're like, wow, this person seems to have like a broad and deep interior life. That's not a person who's hooked on drugs, you know. And again, I mean, I've got about 40 pages in the back of the Porn Myth, I think, that tries to document these studies to show that this isn't just my thought, that this is what the sciences are finding.
I want to talk about the M word, masturbating. You've mentioned it a couple of times during the podcast. You're actually making the case in a very compelling fashion that masturbating is unhealthy.
Right. Yeah. And for a number of reasons. Again, I think it's important that we distinguish the consequences from the act. So I think the act of pornography is intrinsically disordered, whether or not certain negative physical effects take place afterwards, like addiction or erectile dysfunction, right? And I think the same thing's true with masturbation. I think masturbation's a disordered act. I think whenever you thwart the primary end of a natural action, then you've perverted the act. That's why we would say that bulimia is disordered. Whether or not, you know, negative results occur, you would say that the reason you eat is for nutrition. So if you eat in order to get the pleasure of food and then throw up in order to not get the primary purpose of food, that namely nutrition, this is disordered. And I think sex, I think, clearly has at least two ends. You would say, well, it's for the good of those coming together. And there's an openness to life that ought to be there. And I think in masturbation, you get neither. Instead, you have to retreat into a sort of fantasy world where you, as Lewis put it, you keep a harem of imaginary brides that never call for sacrifice. And you're always the perfect lover, always adored. And you begin to think that an orgasm is something that you deserve, you know, and you become start to think of, ejaculation like urination. It's just what you have to do. But this isn't good at all. And so while masturbation is not as bad as pornography and masturbation, that doesn't make masturbation good. It would be like saying smoking one pack of cigarettes a day is less bad than smoking 10, but that doesn't make one packet healthy.
It's interesting that you brought up marriage in a definitional sense that is very, very different from how marriage is defined today. And Catholics still have this sense with respect to a marriage definition where there's an openness to children. But that openness to children phrase or part of the definition is quite frankly missing in most Christian vernacular.
Well, we spoke earlier, didn't we, about if the majority of Christendom has believed one thing and now because of cultural influences we say, well, that's wrong, that should cause us pause. And I know that the Orthodox Church, depending on who you ask, might be a little, well, yes or no on this question, but up until 1930, there wasn't a Protestant denomination, for example, that said contraception was okay. But after around 1930, the Anglican Church allowed it in particular uses. And so, again, I think the Catholic Church is consistent here. If one of the primary ends of the sexual act is an openness to life, then you shouldn't thwart that end. And if you do, and you begin to tell yourself that it's okay to use condoms and this sort of thing, and I know I'm alienating the majority of your audience here, so I apologize, but this is just me speaking off the cuff and speaking as real as I can, then all of a sudden it becomes a little more easier to justify things like masturbation, right? Because you've taken the procreative element out of the act altogether. But anyway, in the book, I don't appeal to religious dogma or to the, you know, church fathers or anything like that. Feel free to push back there, Hank. I'm not trying to be argumentative, but I have an open discussion.
Well, I'll push back when it's appropriate, but I don't think it's appropriate to push back on that. I don't disagree with what you're saying. And I was really struck in the book by this one phrase with respect to the makeup of semen being
right.
different. I mean, that
fascinating,
I had, that was the first time I had ever encountered that idea.
I was too. When I found that, I thought, this is ridiculous. This can't be true. The more I looked into it, it was true. So I hope you're going to use a little disclaimer at the start of this episode. I hope there's no children listening. But basically, the makeup of the ejaculate is different when it's produced by masturbation than when it's produced through vaginal intercourse, which is really weird and fascinating. I don't know what else to say on that. But This is a different act. I think it sends a man or a woman back into themselves. You think, and this is Lewis again, one of the primary purposes of life is to come out of that little shell we're all born into and become a self-gift, right? This is my body given up for you, is what the sexual act says. When we consume pornography or when we masturbate to fantasy, we say, this is your body taken by me. And so instead of loving, we become users. So we sort of flip that call to self-donating love on its head. And so for that reason, I don't think anyone, any Christian, should say that masturbation is okay. I don't think it is at all.
What's really cool about this discussion from my perspective is that I've been saying for years that God sets parameters around our lives so that our joy might be complete. We don't always understand why, but now you get these little insights like, wow, even the makeup of semen is different. Who would have known?
Right.
But if you live within the parameters that God sets forth for you to live within, you're just going to be more content and happy. And so if there is an objective truth, if there's an objective reality, if there is such a thing as natural law, we ought not to be cutting off the very branch we're sitting on.
Right. And again, I want to make it clear in that chapter, I'm not appealing to religion. I'm not even really appealing to natural law in that section. It was more this idea that I looked at a bunch of the different studies, because people like to isolate studies and say, well, look, this proves that this reduces your risk of this or something. Well, the argument is essentially that ejaculation is good for you. Okay, that's not necessarily news. You would think that the act by which the human species is propagated would have positive consequences. That's hardly revelatory. But that doesn't mean that I ought to seek that end through any means possible. You know, if I said, well, if I get together with my mistress before coming home to my wife, it puts me in the mood and I'm able to make love to my wife in a much more intense way that satisfies her. Well, that's great, but that doesn't mean you should be hanging out with your mistress at all. So in fact, when you look at the studies, and I showed this in the chapter, it shows that frequent masturbation leads to more things like anxiety, social awkwardness, prostate abnormalities, continuance in erectile dysfunction if one has that already, and those sorts of things. Anyway, so again, I want to stoop to conquer, right? Like if there's an atheist who disagrees with me on that, I'm not going to spend my time focusing on that. I want to begin at least with pornography and see if I can get him on board there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And another myth in this respect has to do with rape and sexual violence. And whether you're an atheist, whether you're a Buddhist, whether you're a Muslim, whether you're a Christian, whatever you are, the one thing that we ought to be able to agree on is that rape is bad.
Yes. Yes, I think that's fair to say that every person who isn't a garbage dump of a human being agrees with that statement. And so the question then is, does porn lead to sexual aggression or sexual violence? Well, first of all, let's do away with the straw man. No one on my side is saying that everyone who looks at porn will rape or sexually harm another person. No one's saying that. But what we are saying is if someone does sexually violate another human person, there's real good reasons to think that that person's addicted to porn, right? Because when somebody hurts somebody in a sexual way, one thing at least is true, right? The perpetrator doesn't view this person so much as a good to be cherished, but as a thing to be had and used for my sexual gratification. And I can't think of a better delivery method for that mentality than pornography. And if you're still not sure, let me ask you this question. If you had a next door neighbor who enjoyed consuming child pornography, would you be more or less comfortable with them babysitting your kids? Obviously, the answer is less comfortable. And if I were to say, well, why? He has an outlet. You wouldn't find that consoling. And so, in fact, there's actually really good reasons, despite some of the opponents' protestations, that consuming pornography does lead to sexual aggression and violence. I mean, when you consider that the vast majority of pornography involves name-calling, you know, physical aggression like slapping and choking and hitting, there was a study that was done in 2007 that showed this, then that's how you grow up learning about sex. And so the idea that that would have no effect on your sexual behavior is just ridiculous. That's like saying that advertising doesn't work, you know, because we can tell the difference between fantasy and reality. Well, maybe we can't.
Talk about what actually happens to people who are involved in the porn industry, both the brutality against women as well as what happens to the men. The men can injure themselves in a pretty significant way. I don't know how graphic you want to get about this, but the women are definitely violated to an extent of physical harm yeah. that's repulsive, exactly.
Yeah, it's difficult to get in this, and I don't want to get into it with any detail because I'd hate to sort of scandalize anybody. In the book, they enabled me to go to some degree, but needless to say, I mean, there's tearing that takes place. One lady talked about the muscle of a particular organ coming out on set. It's just body punishment. It's torture plus orgasm is what a lot of pornography is today. So yes,
at the face of it, how can anybody think that that is stimulating? I mean, I'm assuming it is, but
right? It is stimulated, but you don't begin there. Like, nobody wakes up at the age of 30 having never watched porn and then thought, I want to watch a gangbang where a girl gets choked and spat on. That's what I'm in the mood for. Nobody wakes up at 30 and says that unless they have become desensitized and feel the need to watch more deviant porn. What that does is that boosts, you know, epinephrine, which boosts dopamine. It's the reason risky sex, right, might feel more and is more sexually pleasurable because there's this risk factor involved which heightens our senses and, again, gives us more pleasure. And so I think it goes from one stage to the next where all of a sudden you think to yourself, God, what am I watching? How did I ever get to this? A year ago, this would have made me sick. Today, it's the only thing that can get me off. And for many people, that's the wake-up call that says to them, I need help, and I need help now.
I want to talk about some strategies. You're a sort of a lightweight. You have four kids. I have 12.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations. How are you not Catholic? I'm just joking.
Or Mormon, right? Everybody asks me, are you a Catholic or a Mormon? Right?
The way you can tell, though, is if they're really attractive, they're Mormon.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas if they look exhausted for some reason and their clothes don't match, they're Catholic.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So strategies. You have four kids. You got to do something about your kids. You care about your kids. I care about my kids. But you mentioned something earlier, which I think all of us ought to hear some alarm bells. Schools are giving kids tablets. Those kids can do what they want with those tablets. We're not monitoring them all the time. What are they going to do? I mean, it's going to devolve to the lowest common denominator. Oftentimes does. What do you do about that? What are strategies that...
Right. Like when I was 8 and 9, my friends figured out really quickly how to write boobies on the calculator when you turn it upside down. Right? Hmm. That's what we did. You know, 8, 0, 0, 8, you know, 1, 3, 4, you know, if that's what we were doing, like if the first thing you did in high school or when you were a kid, perhaps before the internet, is you got a dictionary, the first thing you did was look up sex, right? There's like a natural good curiosity that we all have. But when you give your kids an iPad or an iPhone, what you're giving them potentially is a portable X-rated movie theater. That's what you just gave them. So what do you do? Well, let me just give the short answer real quick. And the short answer is, number one, get my book. Number two, listen to my podcast, Love People Use Things, because I have tons of, you know, episodes and stuff on this where I get into this great detail. The first thing is we have to educate our kids, and I think I've spoken about that a little bit. The next thing is you absolutely have to lock all of your technology down. So this should be something parents, this should be their mantra. If I'm not willing to monitor it, I will not provide it.
But the schools provide it. I mean, that's what,
right.
And the schools are providing the tablets.
And this is why I don't send my kids to I send my kids to a 2-day-a-week classical hybrid school where technology isn't available. So homeschool's an option. Like if you're sending your kids to a public school, maybe that's not a good idea. Like maybe it's, you know, that might be offensive to you, but like maybe I'm wrong, but maybe I'm right. And you need to wrestle with that a little bit. I think we've got to be very serious about the purity of our children. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I tell you, if I was sending my kids to a school that used technology, I'd be next to the principal typing in all sorts of pornographic terms to see just how good their filter is. So parents need to be just, you know, mothers are fantastic at this, you know, like be merciless, like do not let good enough be okay. They need to be having things like Covenant Eyes on their devices, which is a much better, say, filter than others that might just have a blacklist of URLs. And so that would be one way to do it. And then educating parents about the reality of the harms that pornography causes to wake them up. This isn't a rite of passage that's harmless. This isn't just something that old kids do. This is something that could destroy your child right now and in eternity. And so Stooping to Conquer. Again, you don't have to talk about Eternity now, but you can talk about the statistics that I lay out in my book just to educate them. There's a great book. It's a beautifully illustrated book for parents to read to their kids. It's called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures, Porn-Proofing Today's Young Kids. So, I would tell everyone to go get a copy of that on Amazon. That might be the first step. And then to realize that your kids are only as safe as the houses that they play at. So I don't let my kids play at houses where there is unbridled internet access. Why would I do that if I love my kid? I do love my kid, and therefore I don't let them do that. Now, I have lots of friends who agree with me, and so my friends have a very rich social life. It's not like I'm keeping them in a cave or something. They have a lot of fun, you know. They read, they fish, they memorize poetry, they, you know, they wrestle, all those sorts of things. But as someone who's responsible for my kids, I know they're going to see pornography eventually. But there's good studies that have shown that the earlier your kid is exposed to porn, the more likely it is to have a long-lasting detrimental effect in their lives. And so, you know, we talk about not sheltering our kids, and I think there's truth to that, you know. But if your kid is in a thunderstorm, you better shelter your kid. And it seems to me that the environment in which we are is even worse than that. It's more like a hurricane or a tsunami or something's taking place, and you need to shelter your kids from that as best as you're able, and not in a defensive sort of way. I mean, we know from Scripture, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more, and that in the world we'll have trouble, and we should be of good cheer because He has overcome the world. We should not just be defensive. We should be offensive as well and joyful and realize that our kids are going to be wounded, but that's why we have a divine physician. Like, it would be an awful thing to have to deprive your children of the gift of healing. And so, yeah, like, our children are going to receive different things that they're going to have to heal from, but healing's a beautiful thing, and we can trust in our Lord. And at the end of most nights, you know, I go to our blessed Lord and I'm like, Lord, make up for the ways that I fell short today, because I fall short a great deal, you know?
You know, Matt, in many ways, what you just said, particularly at the beginning of your latest rant, I mean, you sounded radical.
I mean, good. I hope that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, to the comment. I mean, get next to your principal and make sure. Well, these times really call for radical action. I mean, this is a very toxic culture, and there has to be a radical way of dealing with it. Because if you don't, your kids are gonna, you know, they're gonna sow to the wind and reap the whirlwind.
Yes, they'll destroy their lives and be damned for all eternity in hell. That's probably what'll happen if you allow them to just imbibe the culture. And if the grace doesn't intervene, I'm not saying that we're responsible for our children's salvation, but when they're young, we are those who we are meant to guard them and shelter them and protect them and guide them. And if we fail at that job, then it would be better if a millstone was tied around our neck and we were thrown into the sea. Now, that sounds radical too. But he walked out of the grave, so I'm going to go with that, you know.
Well, I'm glad you're...
Now, it's funny because this is a book that's non-religious, and all I've done is preach.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure that out. I was just thinking about that. I was thinking, okay, it's a book that's non-religious, so you help people with pornography, but you got to take them the next step.
Yeah, that's right. And I think just like
you're
we
saving
can,
them from something, what are you saving them to, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We need freedom from and freedom for, salvation from, salvation for. And just like we should be and writing books, say that here's the scientific and logical argument against abortion, right? We should write them. They shouldn't all be cloaked in religious terminology. Well, the same thing can be done with pornography. So if you get my book, we don't mention sin. You know, there's no mention of salvation or Christ. All those things are vitally important. I wrote this because so many parents and people said to me, I'd love to give a book to somebody, you know, but all of it's religious. So, and the other thing I want to point out before we wrap up is I don't make a cent from this book. 100% of the royalties go to help sexually trafficked women. There's a group in San Diego called Children of the Immaculate Heart. So I'm not plugging this just so I can make more money. Not that there's anything wrong with that, okay? But I'm plugging it because I think it's a good book that will help you, and you can, you know, people could get it on Audible if they want to listen to it, but they won't get all the footnotes, whereas if they got the book. I do hope people get that, or if not that, you know, they go to websites like fightthenewdrug.com or yourbrainonporn.com. just to learn more about it and to begin having these conversations. Because whether they're going to be awkward or not, the conversations have to be had.
You've got a pretty broad swath of interest, I would imagine, just talking to you. Pornography is foundational. It's a seismic issue. What turns you on? I'm trying to use that word in a different sense, but what turns you on in terms of your life goals? I mean, if you were on your deathbed, what would you have liked to accomplish?
To lead people to Jesus Christ and to be a good husband and a good father. That's it, man. On my deathbed, that's all I want to have said I've done. And like most of our listeners, or almost all of them, I see myself fail at that every day. And when I do, if I look to others, I can say, well, I'm better than them. And grow in pride. If I look to myself, I might become despondent and despair. And that's why I need to keep looking to Jesus, because in him, I sort of see this God who apparently loved me enough to do that for me, even though I don't fully understand why he would bother. And so by his grace, I'm motivated to continue one step at a time. I mean, that's the goal in all of this. So I don't want to give anyone any false impressions. You know, I struggle with, you know, yelling at my kids and, you know, being insensitive to my wife and, you know, being arrogant and snarky on social media. I mean, I'm like everyone else. So I don't want to give anyone the wrong impression if I've come down hard on any position or anyone in particular. And I struggle with lust, and there's times that I'm tempted to look at porn. And, you know, I'm in the battlefield like everybody else. I don't want to give in. And it's worth swinging and to continue swinging. And if we fall, we get back up. And,
you know, that's an interesting comment in and of itself, and it reminds me, I mentioned Joe Dallas earlier. He was in the gay lifestyle for a long time. He just doesn't put himself in the circumstance now because, though he's happily married, he still knows he had those proclivities. And if you've had the kind of background that you alluded to earlier on, from 8 years old, I think it was, with pornography, you still have to fight that temptation and put up guards for yourself just as you're putting up guards for your children.
That's right. And I want to give people hope, because there was a time in my life where I walked around daily trying to resist pornography. It's not like that anymore. Like I can go several months without feeling any inclination to be tempted to this stuff. But then occasionally I'll feel something bubble up inside me. Like this happened, I told my wife about this. This happened several weeks ago. You know, I felt that the beginnings of that temptation, right? That question, I could do that. And I came back to my hotel room after a hard night of work and I had a whiskey in my hand. And I knew myself, I thought, you know what? I'm going to tip this bloody $10 drink down the drain and do something, because I know myself and I'm feeling something going on. And so I did. I tipped that whiskey down the drain and I did something else. And so we have to be, it's like if you received maybe you broke your arm or broke some particular part of your body in a sport when you were young. Well, you might feel like it's fine now, but you got to be aware of it if you're engaging in an activity that needs to use that in any, you know, prominent way, because you know there's a weakness there. And so self-knowledge is a good thing.
I want you to expand on this. I mean, it's just so important. I know you touched on it before, but it just bears repeating the relational aspect. You just mentioned your wife. If you're involved with pornography, if you're involved with other kinds of outlets sexually, you're damaging your wife. You're betraying your wife. Expand on that.
Right. Yeah. So how to put it? I mean, when I married my wife, I said on the altar, I want our love to be free, total, faithful, and fruitful. And then on our wedding night, I said that same thing, but with my body, right? My body said what it said at the altar. I give myself to you freely, totally, faithfully, and fruitfully. And if I use pornography, then very soon my making love to her will be less and less of a free act. It'll be more and more dominated by passion and selfishness. And will it be a total act? Well, it might be, except I also might be thinking of something other than my wife. Will it be faithful? It's the opposite of faithful. I'm being faithless with my mind and with my eyes. Will it be fruitful? Well, it might be fruitful, but I also might, Well, that's too much of a distraction. Let me just say this. I mean, I think the more I would engage in pornography, the more I would want to engage in a way with my bride that was not at all open to life. So you begin to sort of lie with your body. Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise and that other girl, Cameron Diaz, she says to him, "Your body made a promise to me, whether you did or not," talking about them making love the night before, fornicating. And I think that when we make love, our body says something. There's a language to our body. And when we consume pornography, we're lying with our body. And it would certainly be an act of infidelity for me to consume pornography.
And it completely robs you of intimacy.
Right. And just the beauty and the joy I have with my wife. You know, I don't say this. I really mean this. My wife is my best friend. We love each other. She's super funny. She's powerful. She's humble. We joke around together. You know, we tickle, we wrestle, and in non-sexual ways. I just like her. I think she's lovely. And I think that if I was still immersed in pornography, I would have never come to experience the delight of what it meant to have a beautiful marriage. So, you know, I want to be a saint because it's the saints who are fully alive. If you want a boring, irritable life, then be a sinner. But I don't want that. I want a full and beautiful life here and now, and I know I can have that with God's grace, and I'm seeing it to different degrees. It might be more appropriate to say to my wife, "I'm learning to love you," rather than "I love you," because obviously selfishness creeps in and it's very ugly. But I want to love her. I want to be like Christ on the cross to my bride, laying down my life for her. And I fail at it, but I don't want to start justifying the failures and even celebrating them. I want to despise them and repent of them and strive to be a true man of God, you know?
Based on the statistics, I mean, there are a lot of people right now listening in who are struggling with pornography to one degree or another. What advice do you have for those people? Obviously, you've touched on this in many different ways, but I mean, just talk directly to someone who's listening like a fly on the wall. They're struggling with pornography. They agree with what you're saying. What to do next?
Yeah, I think I'd look at them. Let's suppose they're a man for now, and I would say, "Brother, do you want to be free of this?" "Yes." "What are you doing to be free of this?" And your answer better be bloody manly. Because if you say something pathetic to me, like, "Well, I just try not to look at it," I'd want to slap you. If you want to be free of this, then you ought to be investing a lot of your energy in being free of this. This means good counseling. This means good accountability and filtering software. This means praying regularly. And if you're not doing those things, you might want to stop saying you want to be free. Because saying you want to be free and then doing nothing practical about it is like saying, "I want to run a marathon, but I don't really want to exercise or buy sneakers or learn to eat properly." Just admit that you don't want to run a marathon, you know. But if you do want to be free, there's some very practical things that you ought to be doing. I think one is to get my book. The other might be to get covenantized and find an accountability partner. These are sort of the non-essentials. Educate yourself about what it's robbing from you. Get an accountability partner. Be real with somebody. If this is something you've struggled with for a long time, go see a counselor. Find a certified sex addiction therapist. Right? You can find one of them at my website, lovepeoplewhosethings.fm. FM like AM and FM. You could plug in your postal code and it'll find people in your area. Go to a 12-step group. Go to sa.org. You can find a phone meeting or a meeting in person in your area and get serious about recovery. So suppose you're struggling and you haven't told your significant other, presuming you're married. I think it's probably a good idea that you do, but imagine how much more healthy and beautiful and optimistic it would be instead of just complaining about how weak and hard it is, if you said, "I love you, and here are the 10 things I'm doing because I love you. I've started seeing a therapist. I've got covenant eyes. I've got an accountability partner." Like, we just got to get serious because this thing's a cancer and it needs surgery immediately or else it'll take over and kill you. You know, do you remember that movie? Was it called 42 Hours? What was that movie where that bloke got his arm stuck between him and a boulder? And he was dying. He was in Utah. Well, he got his rusty pocket knife and he cut through his arm, bone, sinews, everything. Because it was either that, and that's unthinkable to all of us, right? But it was that or die alone and die then and there or very soon. Something similar is being required of us. Something drastic and radical needs to take place or else it's going to kill you.
And you've already touched this, but I want you to reemphasize it. It's just so critical. You're a parent. I mean, I'm a parent. I've got 12 kids, as I said. I still have a 14-year-old. Goes to a Christian school. But nonetheless, he has a tablet. If you're a mother, if you're a father, once again, underscore the radical measures that you have to take if you really care about the well-being of your children.
So I think it's important to give our children an internal filter for an unfiltered world. So prior to the age of 12, I'd get both filtering and accountability software. Again, Carbonite Eyes is the best. If you use my name as a promo code, FRAD, you get a month free. That might be a way to try it out, but you'll love it. And again, I'm not promoting them because I work for them or anything like that. They just are the best thing out there. But once your child's after 12, you might say, okay, I'm going to remove the filter and just use accountability software. That way, if you do go to any websites you shouldn't, I'll get an email telling me where you went, for how long, what you typed into Google. And I do this not to shame you or to make you feel awkward, but because I love you and I want to be there for you. And so I think, again, we live in an unfiltered world, so we can't just filter and censor everything. We've got to give our children an internal filter and be able to have open communication with them. I know so many parents who say to me that their teens come to them when they've fallen. You know, can I go to confession, mum? Or, you know, can we pray together? And I think that's a beautiful thing. And that the parent should look upon his child or her child the way our blessed Lord looks upon us when we turn to him in repentance, with tenderness and love and joy that he's turned to us, not scolding us, not telling us, I can't believe you did it. You know, not saying, well, my mercy's running out here. But with tremendous love, we got to show that to our kids and not overreact when they've fallen. Apologize to them. If your kids are young and they've fallen to pornography, don't get angry. Apologize, because this was your fault. This wasn't their fault. This is a sexualized culture into which you gave them, you know, you brought them up and then you've given them tablets and things. This is your fault. So you should apologize to them and say, well, we're going to do better. Mom and dad are going to get covenant eyes and we'll all be accountable, because there's no secrets in this family. There's no secrets. So you got to begin. However awkward the conversation will be, better than not having it. So if your kid's older and you've never had this discussion with them, you might say, I heard this interesting podcast with Matt and Hank, and I just want to say to you, if this is something you're struggling with now or ever have, you can always come to me and I would always help you, and I would have a lot of respect for you if you did come to me. Mm. So you don't be afraid. I wouldn't lose respect for you. I'd be very proud of you. That you had such courage and maturity. And they might say, shut up, mom, I'm not doing that. That's gross. But that's going to be in the back of that kid's mind. And if they ever get in over their head, they at least know they can come to you.
That's beautiful. You're an apologist. I mean, you work for Catholic Answers. I think
I used to, yeah.
You used to work for Catholic Answers, but you love apologetics, right? I mean, you wrote a book on apologetics, Does God Exist?
Right.
How big a part of your life is giving people answers on a broader sense? I mean, in concert with the book that you wrote.
Well, I'm, you know, as a Catholic who's very intellectually stimulated by things, like I have my graduate and master's degrees in philosophy. So I love the big questions. I've always loved the big questions. But sometimes people can't ask the big questions because they feel like they're drowning constantly, or they can't receive salvation because they are immersed in pornography. So I think it's funny. 5 years ago, I would say to schools that I would speak to, because I speak to about 70,000 people a year. Hey, I said, you know, can I speak about pornography? 5 years ago, oh golly, no. Just give a basic chastity talk and maybe talk about pornography somewhere in that. Whereas the last 2 years, all people want me to speak about is pornography. We've really reached a tipping point in our culture. So I speak all over the country on this topic in schools, and it's been such a joy. Love it.
Well, you're making a difference, and you're a great podcaster. I'm just getting into podcasting, so I know from talking to my son, I got a lot to learn from you.
Oh, that's nice.
No, he's a big fan. My son David, he told me about you, and you know, I'm really glad to be interacting with you, because I think what you're doing is making a difference for time and for eternity. But you're impacting a lot of people, and you just have been given a great gift of communication. You're a great writer. Love talking to you.
Well, that's very kind of you, Hank. And as I say, I've admired your stuff from afar, and it's a lovely, lovely to talk to you and a joy to be with you today. So thanks for having me.
It was an absolute delight. Again, Matt Fred, he is a speaker, he's a podcaster, he's an author. The book we're talking about is The Porn Myth. He's also written Does God Exist? A Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. And he's making a difference for time and for eternity. This is one of the most important podcasts we've ever done because the subject matter is transcendently important. I started out saying that pornography is an enslaving addiction. It's a violation of marriage. It's a precursor to increasingly dangerous and degrading sexual practices. When you think about the addictive behavior of pornography, the fact that it enslaves the mind, it conditions users to view others as mere objects of self-gratification. Remember the words of our Lord when he said that we ought to guard our gaze because the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body is going to be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Pornography also, as Matt pointed out so well, it breaks the sacred bond of marriage, and as such, it tears apart the very fabric of society. When pornography is used to satisfy sexual desire, remember, you're betraying a marriage partner. And then the addictive part cannot be overemphasized, because just as marijuana is a precursor to experimenting with more dangerous substances, so pornography often leads to increasingly degrading sexual behaviors. And now you're at a place, as Matt pointed out, where you can't believe that you're actually doing what you're doing. There is a solution. The ultimate solution is Christ, who transforms us and allows us to experience life right now that is more than tepid. It is life that is abundant. It is life that is life to the full. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. You can make a difference by taking an action step. Go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Also, let other people know about this podcast. Let people know about Matt Fred and The Porn Myth, exposing the reality behind the fantasy of pornography. We'll be right back at you in future editions of Hank Unplugged. Thanks for tuning in to this edition. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.